Teaching Independent Thinking in a Digital Dependent World was the keynote address presented by Davies Owens at the Gutenberg 2024 Education Conference, titled The Independent Mind. Davies Owens is the founder and host of the Basecamp Live podcast and has over three decades of experience in classical Christian school leadership. We hope you enjoy this presentation.
Here we are tonight, and I'm so grateful to be with you. I have truly enjoyed coming in. Amanda and I were talking about just the unique environment that this conference is and the wonderful way that you guys are in truly living out the very thing that we so want to embody in our schools and our classrooms of connectedness and belonging. And I can tell you, if you were in my workshop, you saw this, got to brag on my family. And I'm bragging in part because as a classical Christian educator, I think in my 24th year, I remember well standing at open houses as a head of school in Atlanta and bragging about the wonders of classical Christian education when my oldest was in third grade, thinking, I hope this works out. I think it's good. I'm not sure yet. I'm here tonight as an empty nester to tell you that all three of my children have finished all the way through K-12 classical Christian. They've gone on into life and college and work and beyond. My daughter there on my right is married. She married a classical Christian young man. Best thing you can hope for is all your daughters will marry a classical Christian young man. And so in all seriousness, very blessed and very grateful. And as I've moved into that season in my life of just thinking deeply about what is the highest and best use of our calling right now. There's a lot of things that we have to worry about in the world today. And I'm firmly committed, and I believe with all my heart, that the last best hope for our world today, well, it's certainly Jesus. But I think the next thing in that list would be the work that goes on every day of forming the next generation through classical Christian education. Someone said this is what is keeping our society from tyranny right now. And so I just want you to know, if you've been head down educating, put your head up and look around. What I see as I've traveled around the country, as I engage people around the world, there is a movement afoot of a lot of folks who are saying we got to do something differently. And it's the whole C.S. Lewis idea. Let's maybe turn and go back from the direction from which we came. Let's anchor into this thing called classical Christian education. And I'm very excited to see the work going around the world. I had a woman emailed me, a Basecamp Live listener, a podcast listener in Japan, just 2 weeks ago, and she said, I think I'm the only person in Japan doing classical Christian education. And I'm so grateful because I believe so much that this is the best hope in a very secular country. So if you feel like you're the only one out there, I think she may be the only one out there. But I do want to talk tonight about the challenges before us. Chris and I just, as we were preparing for this, thought, let's really hit head on this issue of digital dependence in the world today. And I would say as we kind of work our way into that, I want to just say I think there's a vulnerability that we as classical Christian people and as those who are kind of keepers of the ways of old are a bit vulnerable maybe when it comes to looking at this topic. You know, we believe Hebrews 13:8, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Amen to that. Ecclesiastes 1:9, there is nothing new under the sun. We are quite committed to the great books that we say all the time. They have stood the test of time. If you said they've stood the test. So we come into this moment with a lot of anchor points, rightly so, that hold fast to things that never change. And yet we are here in the midst of serving a generation of millennial and Gen Z parents that are engaging our schools, and they're part of our network. They're parenting the next generation. And the way that they engage the world is a bit different than it was when I stepped into this 20-some years ago. I remember early on as a head of school, the families that would show up at our school, you know, they had the well-trained mind under this arm and the lost tools of learning, and they would come in all ready to have a conversation. What do we have today? We have families that come in that are committed, that check the box, they go to church, but what? Their youngest is on an iPad during the interview. Could you fake it at least through the interview? Like, don't, you know, claim you read the book, something. And yet we've got to be, I think really the vision in my head is this kind of obscure passage in 1 Chronicles 12:32, taking on the posture of the sons of Issachar. Remember this little passage, which says that the sons of Issachar were men who understood the times and therefore knew what Israel should do. So my goal tonight is to help us understand the times. We may not like the times. We may disagree with them. We may find them to be frustrating. But the times around us are kind of filled with what I believe Lewis really hit right on the head when he said, you know, a man who has lived in many places is not likely to be deceived by the local errors of his native village. The scholar has lived in many times and is therefore in some degree immune, I love this, from the great cataract of nonsense that pours from the press and the microphones of his own age. What would Lewis say today? I think he'd say, I think it's not like cataract. I think they got glaucoma. I think it's going to be a problem. There's a lot of nonsense around us today. And as we look around, I came across this definition of barbarians. Tell me this isn't somewhat reminiscent. These barbarians are like children, unable to speak or reason properly, cowardly, effeminate, luxurious, cruel, unable to control their appetites and desires, and politically unable to govern themselves. Like, I think there's some barbarians in our midst. I would go so far to say, I don't think the barbarians are at the gates. I think the barbarians have come into the native villages, and they are, in fact, not only in our homes at the dinner table, but they're now hanging out in the bedrooms with our children. And one of the hardest things for us when it comes to thinking about what to do is, I will admit, I find myself relating to these guys all the time. You remember these guys? Anybody remember their names? Come on, Gen Xers, where are you? What was it? Statler and Waldorf, yeah. I feel just like these guys. I want to lean over the balcony and go, hey, get a flip phone, stop, you know, hey. You are the authority in your home. You know, no gentle parenting. You know, I want to go to church. I mean, I just want to be that guy. And it seems like that would just fix everything because we could just sort of rail from the balcony down into the world of the barbarians and see if we could change it all. But I want to encourage us tonight as we get into this. I want to challenge us, as I challenge myself, we got to have grace and compassion for the millennial Gen Z families that are showing up into our schools, into our families. Some of you are millennial Gen Z, I'm sure. Some of you may be even Gen Alpha in here. The reality is that we're all trying to do the best we can to seek after Jesus and to try to raise the next generation. I had an experience a couple of years ago that I think really helped frame up for me kind of how to take a perspective on this. The school that I led in Atlanta, Heritage Preparatory School, the head of our board was a vice president of Chick-fil-A. So in all seriousness, I feel like a Chick-fil-A owner-operator because I was always being invited out to the corporate campus and went through a lot of different executive training, and I never learned to make waffle fries. I'd hoped that was going to happen, but I did have the experience of a very unique closed-door session that I'll never forget. They called it the BTR, Beyond the Restaurant. This was about 6 years ago or so. And the whole idea was they took a whole day, they brought in their whole C-suite of leadership, they brought in a big marketing group, and they spent the whole day just saying, the customers outside the doors are changing. And we can be frustrated by that, or we can think as a business about how we pivot appropriately to address this changing world outside our doors. And so there were things like the fact that at that point, 279 different meal delivery services like Uber Eats were coming online. And so the typical customer wasn't coming into the Chick-fil-A restaurant and playing on the plastic, you know, playground in there so much as they were sitting in their homes and ordering on DoorDash or whatever it would be. And so here's a restaurant thinking, we got to get ahead of this. We got to think differently because things are shifting in front of us. And so one of the things that I think we have to do tonight is kind of a BTS, beyond the school. We're not abandoning anything that we're about, but we've got to acknowledge there's a shift going on. I think more than anything, I would say tonight is an opportunity for us to really think kind of with a missional view. You know, I've had the privilege of going to Rwanda 4 times and working in that country, and the teams that I've taken over there to work with a classical Christian school, we think a lot about what's culturally appropriate, what's different in that culture. How do we go in as a missionary? And that seems normal, but for us here, it's like, I want to go back to the old guys going, get your act together. And it's like, wait a minute, maybe we need to be sensitive to understand what those pressures are that are coming in so quickly. And how do we sort of juggle between these three circles where our children are getting pulled between the circles of what's happening in the parents' culture, in the school's culture, in the world's culture? And you could put church in there as part of the parents' culture. I think the real question for us is, can we soberly look for a few minutes at some of the things that are happening BTS, beyond the school today? Some of these will feel familiar to you. I tend to think of this as sort of looking at the currents, the weather patterns that are shifting out there in the broader culture. And there is a bit of a category 5 there in the middle that's swirling up. And some of these storm systems have been there for a while, and some of them are flaring up more than they've ever done before. And I want to think tonight a little bit about the idea of what's happening in the culture around us. And I'm going to kind of quickly go through 5 of these kind of cultural pivots, these shifts that are happening. And then I want to look at 3 potential ways we can maybe rethink what we're doing as purveyors of classical Christian education to better address the needs of this changing customer base. Number one, I want to start with, again, I think all of us are going to be like, yeah, the speed of life. 24 hours a day, massive shift in the way most parents allocate their time. You know, time equals influence. I started thinking, what are all the ways that 24 hours gets sort of divided up by the typical family today? And I did a little bit of a back of the napkin. I just said, okay, what can you be doing typically families today? Well, you're probably going to be in school. You're going to be at home. Hopefully there's a little sleeping and eating. There's screen time. We'll talk about that. There's church time, and there's kind of extra, which is the discretionary time you have to go do things that you choose to do as a family. Welcome to America today. The purple represents church. Even though those who go to church check the box, covenant families, it averages about 17 minutes a day prorated over the week that they're actually getting kind of church influence in their 24-hour day. The average American teen today spends between 7 to 11 hours on a screen. Not our classical Christian schools. Well, I don't know. Well, that's something to be thought about. But the majority of students today, that's the loudest voice. The green represents home. And home is a reality that I think the sobering truth, somebody said recently, the statistic that still haunts me a bit, that 75% of the time you will spend with your children in your lifetime will be over by the age of 12. And 90% by the time they're 18, which means your influence shuts down really quickly, critical influence. But as God designed it, they're to leave and cleave. They're to leave that house at 18. So the typical American home today is about less than 7 minutes, and a lot of that's don't forget your gym bag on the part of mom and dad. You look at the red is school. Whatever flavor of school, school generally dominates a huge chunk of about 6 hours. You've got the white area that's kind of extra. Extra could be anything for most American families, according to a stat I read recently, 58% are involved in two or more after-school activities because of a combination of FOMO, fear of missing out. We don't want our kid to not do the thing. Some mom guilt, I got to keep up. Maybe dad pressure, whatever it's coming from. That is dominating their schedule. So they show up at 8 o'clock at night. They're already tired, and they wonder why you give them too much homework. And then there's this thing called sleeping and eating, which for most kids today is at an incredibly subpar level. So there's a fragmentation of the wholeness around families today. And a lot of that speed of life is just almost unavoidable. Again, another fascinating statistic I read that scientists have measured the amount of data that enters the brain and found that the average person living today processes as much as 74 gigabytes of information a day. That's like the length of, that's the amount of data of 16 movies on a hard drive through computers and phones and billboards, over 60,000 brand impressions. Every year, it's about 5% more than it was in the previous year. Interestingly, only 500 years ago, 74 gigabytes of information would have been what a highly educated person would have consumed in a lifetime through books and stories. So again, just understand this is the mission field we're called into. No wonder Nicholas Carr in 2010 wrote the book The Shallows, which he wrote this: something or someone is tinkering with my brain, remapping the neural circuitry, reprogramming the memory. I'm not thinking the way I used to think. I feel it more strongly when I'm reading. I used to find it easy to immerse myself in a book or a lengthy article. My mind would get caught up in the twist of the narrative and the turns of the argument. I'd spend hours scrolling through long stretches of prose. That's rarely the case anymore. Now my concentration starts to drift after a page or two. I get fidgety. I lose the thread. I begin to think of something else to do. I feel like I'm always dragging my wayward brain back to the text. The deep reading that used to come naturally has become a struggle. Speed of life. Anybody relate? It's real. It's for all of us. How about this? The rise of self and the loss of absolutes. Again, we've spent a whole day talking about variations on this. I'm not going to go into a lot of it, but again, what is the impact of a generation that basically operates with no transcendent authority around it? Aaron Zillner, Wall Street Journal, wrote an article, America pulls back from the values that once defined it. Religion down 62% to 39% just in the last 10 years or so. Patriotism down 70% to 38%. Having children down 59% to 30%. Community involvement down from 62% to 27%. And as we talked today in many of our discussions with Jockey Lula around propaganda, there's a gap that will be filled by something. And that space is getting filled by a new religion. And that new religion is all about a loss of absolutes and a rise of self. Moral relativism, nothing is right or wrong. Religious equivalency, all religions are equally the same. a condescending disdain for evangelical Christians. Anybody seen the Paris Olympics? U.S. is the source of the world's problems. Global warming is an existential threat. Validation of LGBT agenda. All people are basically good. What's interesting, Barna recently did a study in which they asked how many church-going Christians, they surveyed to see church-going Christians, which are, again, coming in our schools, checking the faith, I go to church box. But when they surveyed, only 4 to 6 of them, according to Barna, have a biblical worldview, as they defined it. And so you mix that in with this sort of, again, cultural moment that we're in, it adds a whole other layer of complexity around how do we engage deeply this generation. Next kind of challenge of the currents swirling around, those are the stats I just read, is the loss of generational wisdom. This is fascinating to me and truly sad. When I have traveled around the country speaking, I'll often gather young millennial Gen Z families, mainly grammar school parents, and I'll just say, I want to have a conversation with you. I want to know how many of you, raise your hand if you live within 100 miles of your extended family, and people raise their hands. Interestingly, the statistic is that only about 30% of the families coming to your schools live within a 100-mile radius of their extended family. So where is generational wisdom coming from? Is that generational wisdom coming from James Dobson? Like, I remember? No. It's coming from YouTube. It's coming from podcasts. It's coming from, as one mom said in Atlanta, a cacophony of competing information. So it's a generation that's showing up actually quite hungry and interested, but not really sure where to go, and getting a lot of mixed messages, which is why sort of the gentle parenting, or I like to call it bohemian parenting, is very popular, where our children are sort of co-equals with us as we go through life. Generational wisdom is a huge challenge, and I think just as an aside, we talked about it in the breakout. If you come tomorrow, we'll talk about it again more, but we have this asset called grandparents that are right in our midst in many cases, and how do we involve them more to help think about the generational shifts that are going on? What's another kind of cloud that's forming out there? I'm like, you guys are getting so depressed. Like, this is the worst talk I've ever seen for after dinner. We're going to get some good news in a minute. Welcome to the world of distraction and leisure. Some of you may feel like that right now. I heard recently Andy Crouch did an interesting kind of juxtaposition of the biblical notion of working as God called us, Adam, to work in the garden and then to rest on the Sabbath, in contrast to the modern world, which is one of toiling, which is how most people feel about their jobs today, with the offset being now I deserve leisure. So we're going to go binge Netflix because we hated our job all day. There's so many people, so many parents that sort of have this toiling mentality and leisure mentality. And so that just plays even further as we're looking into the digital barbarians to the I deserve a break today. Schaefer said, you know, one of the greatest challenges to our world is this idea of personal peace and affluence, when he says practical materialism is difficult to escape in any age, but it is especially hard today because we all tend to be influenced by the spirit around us. And in the United States and the Western world, most people have only two values, personal peace and affluence. Many young people rejected their parents' style of materialism only to come around in a big circle of their own kind. As long as they have enough money to pay for their lifestyle, have that Netflix subscription, they really care about nothing else. So edutainment is sort of the new world of education, which is we're going to entertain ourselves, and we want to find schools where our kids can be entertained with math, iPad things, and clowns will pop up and tell you you're doing a great job. Addictive distractions. I think it has all of the ingredients of sort of Huxley's Soma, which he said has all the advantages of Christianity and alcohol, but none of the defects. Remember that? And consequently, today in America, the American Consumer Satisfaction Index is at an all-time low because you can only eat so many Cheetos and watch so many Netflix and try to escape from your toil. And so a lot of the families that are showing up today are at higher levels of anxiety and depression than ever before, only further because of their own self-medication through digital technology. C.S. Lewis once said, "By starving the sensibilities of our peoples, we make them easier prey to the propagandist when he comes. For famished nature will be avenged, and a hard heart is no infallible protection against the soft head." So we're again watching the clouds and the swirls of the culture, and these people are showing up in our schools, and we have the opportunity to serve them. But the ultimate eye of the hurricane, which we're really going to talk about tonight, is basically techno intrusions. And I want to, you know, when I think about technology, I want to, let's just kind of frame it this way and say, first of all, this isn't a new problem. Some of you probably know better than I do because you're better scholars of the ancients. You know, Socrates had some issues with technology. You guys aware of that? He wasn't a real big fan of this thing called writing. I was like, really? What's wrong with writing? Well, back in the day, that was a technology. And he expressed concerns that it would lead to the decline of memory and the ability to think deeply about ideas. He's probably right. If you look at the Hebrew oral tradition, it was probably a better way to hold on to information, and then writing came along. So again, we're not the first ones. This isn't like, oh wow, Steve Jobs messed up the world. There's been a lot going on before that. And yet technology is not a bad thing. I wouldn't be here, you realize. I wasn't going to walk from Boise. I mean, I had to ride a plane. That's technology. The Roman roads were pretty integral to the spreading of the gospel. That's technology. So I don't think we're here tonight, hopefully, to lean over the balcony and just rant against all of the technology. But I think we got to figure out how do we serve and how do we engage in the world in which we're in at this point. It is sad. I think many of us are the last generation who even remember what the world was like without the internet. And yet that's the world that we've got to serve into. Today, we have about 95 million photos and videos that are posted on Instagram every day. And 500 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube every single minute. When Postman wrote Amusing Ourselves to Death, he was concerned about the fact that there was a telegraph line that was put in a small town. So the little people in the little Kansas town were now learning about the hotel fire in New York, and they were all abuzz about stuff that really didn't matter. Again, what would Postman say today? We have absolutely crossed over the Rubicon. And what I want to talk about here just for a few minutes, I think, is the degree to which that technology has shifted even of late. The rise of AI, I think, has ever all of us sort of kind of holding tight, like, oh my goodness, what is this new thing? Just when we thought we had Google figured out, we got AI coming. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman interviewed a group that had been working on the ChatGPT-4 platform, and when he saw it for the first time about in August of 2003, he said, we've basically, he said he equated it to the tornado scene in The Wizard of Oz. He said, basically, we've been swept away from the mundane and the black, and while Kansas and white Kansas to the gleaming futuristic land of Oz where everything is in color. He says, we're about to be hit by such a tornado. Friedman went on to explain this is a Promethean moment, one of those moments in history where certain new tools, ways of thinking, or energy sources are introduced that are such a departure and an advance on what existed before that you can't just change one thing, you have to change everything. That is how you create, how you compete, how you collaborate, how you work, how you learn, how you govern, and yes, how you cheat, commit crimes, and fight wars. He listed the key Promethean events of the last six centuries, the invention of the printing press, the scientific revolution, the agricultural revolution, combined with the industrial revolution, the nuclear power revolution, and the personal computing and the internet. Then he said artificial intelligence is another such movement. So again, I'm not here to say this is the worst thing ever. I think there's a lot of things that will be wonderful about AI. In fact, I did a podcast recently with an AI expert who said, honestly, classical Christian students, if they are interested in this, are going to be the most desired within the AI industry because AI, all it is large language, just a big indexing system. It's not some cyborg. But the ability to control AI is based on how well you can write prompts, which is based on your understanding of logic and rhetoric. So it's interesting that our students, who are often thought of as the Amish kids, are actually going to be better and more desired in that industry. So there's a lot of interesting positives in the midst of all that. However, the moment we're in where the techno distractions are at us is at a level that I would say I'm just now, I think, even coming to understand that this is really a full-blown addiction. At a level, we've heard that said, but I think we're going to look back on this when we realize what's going on with big tech algorithms, that there's something here even more ominous than all of that. I wonder sometimes when I think back on some of my own story. This is my father in the 1950s, and my dad grew up in a world where there was this thing that was very heralded as the greatest idea for everyone. It was called smoking. Do you remember smoking? Interestingly, smoking is kind of just gross by millennials and Gen Z today. But there was a day where smoking was actually not just endorsed and accepted, but it was something that was so common that there were even doctors that were out there promoting smoking. I don't know if you may be aware of this. Let me show this to you.
A busy doctor as he makes his daily round of calls, you'd find yourself having a mighty busy time keeping up with him. Time out for many men of medicine usually means just long enough to enjoy a cigarette. And because they know what a pleasure it is to smoke a mild, good-tasting cigarette, They're particular about the brand they choose. In a repeated national survey, doctors in all branches of medicine, doctors in all parts of the country were asked, "What cigarette do you smoke, doctor?" Once again, the brand named most was Camel. Yes, according to this repeated nationwide survey, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. Why not change to Camels for the next 30 days and see what a difference it makes in your smoking enjoyment? See how Camels agree with your throat. See how mild and good-tasting a cigarette can be.
So my father, who lived in a cultural moment where he was told as a young teenager that this is normal and acceptable, of course, quickly picked up cigarette smoking. Unfortunately, he passed away about 6 years ago from lung cancer. So I look at smoking and I think about the moment that we're in with technology, and I think that we're aware as classical Christian educators that this digital barbarians in Babylon are problematic. But I think that the level to which the technology is impacting our families is something, and in our classrooms, is at a level that we probably don't understand. We're going to look back, I think, and someone's going to roll the iPad ad in 50 years ago. Can you believe they thought that was good to put in schools? Can you believe that this was what children were, routinely given? But the problem that I want to talk about, and I want to get to some solutions, is really what I think, if anybody's read Shoshana Zuboff's book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for Human Future at the Frontier of Power, is probably the most concerning, which is really the reality, of course, that the algorithms are now so sophisticated that each one of us is basically, having content curated to our particular likes and dislikes, so that we're able to live in these echo chambers that are sort of curated to force us into a particular direction. She talks in the book about, for instance, the video game Pokemon Go, in which not only are users being locations being tracked, but the game is now collecting far more information than just names and locations. It can access the content of your USB storage, your accounts, your photographs, your network connections, and your phone activities. It can even activate your phone while it is on standby mode. That's definitely true with Google right now. So the idea of surveillance capitalism is sort of lending itself to the ability for businesses and whoever dark forces there may be to say, let me just drive particular stories and information to you in a particular way, which is why we have such a problem that we have. So again, this is there's a lot we can talk about it, but there's so many things we can point to. It's interesting that even like Mark Zuckerberg himself admitted in a recent Senate hearing that he wants his own children to spend no time on any of his Meta products or Facebook products. He says, the business model, he says, this is Zuckerberger, their business model is predatory, and children's developing brains are particularly vulnerable to their products' dopamine-inducing features. And dopamine does not create satisfaction or lasting pleasure. Like a cigarette from Camels. It only produces cravings that the means have become the ends. And so we have a generation that's completely losing agency, losing freedom, and being addicted into something. And by the way, the hard part of all of this is that it's not just, the children. It's us. We live in this world too. I read recently, this is fascinating, it was an educational conference. I don't think this was classical, but it's interesting. An educational conference of 500 teachers were in the room. The speaker told the teachers to hand their phones to the person next to them and then put their phones away. When he asked 15 minutes later how they were feeling about not having their phones, most shared that it was, quote, making them crazy to the extent they could not focus on the ongoing talk. These are adult educators in a conference on education. Millennials recently surveyed said that in their work environment, they would rather give away their sense of smell than lose a device connection. I didn't even know it was a choice, but that's really fascinating. No doubt that's why it's estimated that there's a $15.5 billion loss in productivity each week in America due to technology. So with that happy news of all the storms on the horizon and my dad smoking up there, and we're looking at a moment in time, again, where what are we going to do with this? So my job tonight is in some ways to kind of throw a little cold water out there and go, wow, this is the world around us. And even though I know many of you have made really great and wise decisions on what technology is going to look like in your homes, the families that are showing up into our schools that we are called to serve are living in this sort of cesspool of technology. And so it's challenging us, and this is, I'm talking about this in our workshop, which is, what now is this new role that we are finding ourselves in of having to speak into things that maybe we would have hoped parents would have figured out on their own? So what can we do as classical Christian schools, aside from, again, a long story on all the best practices we should be saying to families or schools right now that are implementing for sure no technology in the school that has to do with smartphone, personal devices, school that I'm going to be speaking at in 2 weeks in Kansas that has just implemented the Yonder bag. Yonder, interestingly, was a device that was created by secular comedians because they were sick and tired of people coming to their show holding the, you know, not engaging and being present when they should be present. So the Yonder bag, you walk in, you put your device in a locked canvas bag. There's a magnetic lock on it. And when you leave the concert, you just magnetic unlock and go out. Where schools are not going, we need that. And it feels like, well, we should be teaching self-restraint and discipline. I'm like, I agree, but sometimes you just have to put a fence up. We put fences up around playgrounds with young children, even though we want to teach them to be careful. So I think that we as schools, and again, some of you are homeschooling, you're like, I'm so glad we're not in a normal school. But I would just say, those are real world decisions that we're going to have to make as schools with policies, and we're going to have to stand strong to the currents of families that are coming to us and saying, yeah, but I'll never forget I had a father when I was at Ambrose, who thought he was being loving, and I think he probably was being loving, but the execution was not so helpful, which was he gave his third grader a Apple Watch. And he thought it was great because he could just text these sweet little memes and hearts and love yous, and like, oh, go, it's an amazing dad. Problem is, dad, like everybody in the whole classroom hears the phone, the little thing buzzes, and little Susie looks at it, and everybody looks at it, and I'm like, you're giving little dopamine hits to your daughter in third grade. You're not helping us. We need to help you understand. We want you to love your daughter, but that's not the best way to do it. So tonight, I want to look at just some ways. How do we recover the independent mind in a moment of such challenge with the digital world around us? And this is why I'm so committed to the work that we're doing every day with classical Christian education. So I would begin by, I want to make three points of focus for us. I would say that some of the biggest things that we've got to recapture or entrench in further on is that we're part of an absolute education. And what I mean by that is that the only way out of really finding what it means to have an independent mind, of course, and Chris alluded to this, is actually you don't really want an independent mind. You want a dependent mind on the right thing. And the right thing is the person of Jesus Christ, full stop. That is the only hope we have, is Jesus Christ. We all talked about, you know, Jacques Ellul's reality, of propaganda, that there's this empty hole that will be filled. We all have to basically, as theologian Bob Dylan once said, you got to serve somebody. Remember this song? You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You may like to dance. You may like heavyweight championship of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed. You're going to have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or maybe the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. And what I see when I look out at classical Christian schools, and this is a real challenge, I'm going to shoot straight with you tonight. I think that we talk a good talk when it comes to truth, goodness, and beauty. But when I look at our graduates and I talk to our alumni, I think sometimes we don't, what I call, connect the dots all the way. We don't, as one who's been to England on several occasions, and you get down the underground, and it's called the mind, the gap. We got to close the gap. What I mean by closing the gap is that sometimes we stop with what are really just cliches when we talk about the true and the good and the beautiful. We risk what I call kind of the character, virtue, value challenge of creating kind of a paideia for our students that is just, it's true, but it's just not complete. Like, help me get from that wonderful idea to reality. You remember back in the early 2000s, there were all these motivational posters that corporate America maybe started using, like the one of the guys in the rowboat, and they're rowing, or they're on the crew and they're rowing together, and underneath it says teamwork. And under that, it says something like, it's the fuel that allows common people to attain uncommon results together. And you're like, well, yeah, that's good. I don't really know what that means. I don't know how to go do that. I don't know what that's all about. And I think sometimes we in our and again, I say this with all kindness, but sometimes we are so quick to say, well, we talked virtues and we talked about prudence and justice and we had this wonderful conversation. It was so rich. Our students walk out of the classroom and they're like, I feel like I just heard about teamwork. I'm not real sure what to do with that. David Hicks and Norms of Nobility says, we describes the modern school as the institution dominated by the aimless tyranny of value-free analysis. Harry Blamire's in his book, The Christian Mind, How the Christian Should Think, challenges and says, there is no longer a Christian mind. There is still a Christian ethic, a Christian practice, a Christian spirituality, and we tend to think pragmatically or politically, but we don't think Christianly. The Christian mind, by cultivating the eternal perspective, will bring a totally different frame of reference to bear that touches all human success or failure, human joy or misery, human health or pain. In short, there's nothing in our experience which will not look different in the Christian mind versus the secular mind. And so I think connecting the dots, really, what does it mean to take every thought captive to Christ, as it says in 2 Corinthians? What does it mean that wisdom and virtue are to be pursued in a practical way in the world? And I think when we talk utilitarian pragmatics, we get uncomfortable because we feel like we're kind of compromising and kind of going into a progressive mode of education. But I think the generation in front of us needs wisdom at a practical level. Moms and dads need to be told specifically what technology should be implemented in their home. Classrooms where we're talking about the great ideas, we need to bring it one step further down into what does this mean in our actual day-to-day world today. But we are ultimately living in a world that is going to only be strengthened if we follow this idea of an absolute education, where we're linking to what Erasmus says, all studies, philosophies, rhetoric are followed for this one purpose, that we may know Christ and honor him. This is the end of all learning and eloquence. So the question is, at the end of every lesson plan, at the end of every conversation, think, did this connect them back to Christ? You can't do it perfectly every time. Or do we leave them with kind of a classical Christian motivational poster? Let's go out and be virtuous. Okay. In the meanwhile, my phone just lit up and there's a lot of stuff over here that's a lot more interesting. How do we, and again, I'm not saying we have to make it fun, but how do we make it what I would say is sort of the next kind of answer to this, jump through these, a beautiful education. And so then truth, goodness, and beauty, this actually came up this morning. Where's beauty fit into this? I think beauty is one of the most powerful antidotes to the digital barbarians. The fact of the matter is we can win the affection game because we have better stories, we have better sentiments. In classical Christian education over the years, I've noticed, we're talking with several folks over the years about this, that I think there's three generations of classical Christian education. Gen 1 was kind of what came along in the early 80s. And it was a lot of folks that had read Doug Wilson's book or others and had sort of dusted off the lost tools writings of Dorothy Sayers, and just thought, well, I think basically we could do this again, but we're basically going to do the same. We're going to make it all about the trivium. And so it's sort of like the trivium became the answer to what is classical Christian. And that's right to an extent, but that's not really enough. And then Gen 2 is kind of early 90s. I actually have somewhere a screenshot of a classical Christian school in the early 90s that was sort of promoting itself, and it was promoting it by having about a 4-foot-tall stack of the great works of Western civilization. All of them were sort of there. And next to it, they put a little girl. She was about 4 feet tall, too. Problem is, if you zoomed in on the photo, her eyes are like all bloodshot. And I'm like, wow. I love the great books. But is that classical Christian education? We're just going to, do the rigor thing to the point that we're just going to push it and push it. Is that what it is, or something more than that? And I think Gen 3, we kind of realize that whole beauty thing, the idea that we're actually shaping what they love, really is pretty significant. And in fact, I think it's the answer to the balancing act of only teaching the truth. Quick story: a number of years ago, I actually was at a big school conference, and like school conferences tend to do, at the end of the evening, we all were sitting out on the back porch, and everyone was doing what classical people do: smoke pipes and talk about lofty things. And next to us was a recent graduate of a classical Christian high school, and she was talking to one of the teachers. Was also out there, and the teacher tapped us on the shoulder, tapped me on the shoulder, and then said, "Hey, can I just interrupt for a minute? I want her to share with you something. This is a graduate, just graduated. This is June. She graduated in May from a classical Christian school, and she said, I love my school, and I'm so grateful for it, but I need to share something. I'm really struggling right now because so much of what I heard in school was about defending truth at all costs." And she said, "Truth was like this giant ruler." And she said, "I graduated with my giant ruler, and I moved out into the world, and I had a problem even loving things that I once loved because I would analyze it. Truth, false, that's allegory, that's not allegory." And this sort of very truth-lent brain, she said, was so offset to beauty and goodness kind of got left out. And I just found myself struggling to love Jesus. I found myself sort of being judgmental and kind of reductionistic and overthinking everything in this very black and white kind of a way. She said, I went on my senior trip and I went in a cathedral, and all I could think about was all the heresies that had been preached there, as opposed to what about the beauty of the architecture, anything that I might notice. And so that story just really gripped me, and I thought, we have in our disposal something so beautiful, so much more desirable, if presented well, over against so much of the emptiness of what's out there in the digital space, if we can present it well. Lewis says that bare, unadorned facts must be supported by sentiment in order to produce a clear course of action. I think there's a problem with Nancy Reagan. Remember Nancy Reagan back then? Just say no to drugs. You know the problem with that? There was nothing to say yes to. There was nothing more beautiful. Thomas Chalmers talks about that in The Power of a New Affection. We're all about ranting against the vices, but we've never really led them with virtues that are more beautiful. And so I think, loving, knowing, if we get it right, if we teach them to love well, to know and to desire truth, goodness, and beauty, it will lead to them embodying gratitude and virtue and wonder, which is what we want. And now their lives reflect even greater beauty. So how do we do that? I want to just real quickly, I know time is short, but I want to just kind of jump very practically. And I think one of the other real challenges of our movement is how do you bring education alive in the classroom? How do you make this information, this truth, beautiful? And when I first became a head of school, I remember I was handed The Well-Trained Mind. Go read that. I'm like, okay, this is good. I kind of get the curriculum thing. But how do you do it? How do you actually walk in a classroom and winsomely bring beauty out in the classroom? I've been, for years, a fan of Charlotte Mason. And I know Charlotte Mason is one of those kind of, maybe misunderstood. I remember years ago at an ACCS conference, it was entitled, "Did Dorothy and Charlotte Get Along?" I thought, that's a great topic. Because the perception is, and sometimes, Dorothy Sayers was, kind of our shining light. And Charlotte Mason, who, by the way, is completely classical, was fighting against many of the things that we've been fighting against, is sort of dismissed as this sort of Montessori butterfly-chasing lady over here for, a few homeschool co-ops. The reality is Charlotte Mason understood, I think, in many ways, the way that we can engage well to make things beautiful as we go through the learning process. And there's a lot, this is a whole talk in of itself. Oh, I meant to tell you, she's going to have a neck ache, but she's in wonder now. She's so excited. So this idea of just real quickly, kind of this triad, when we think about how we execute classical Christian education to make it beautiful, I think there's something that Mason really understood that maybe we miss sometimes. And here's the three ingredients in the classroom, right? It's pretty simple. There's a person being taught, there's the text, and there's the teacher. How do these interplay together? Let's just quickly, I want to work on this for a second. We think about the text. I think we got this down as classical schools because we understand the power of a living book. That's why we don't use anthologies. And we read the living books that stood the test of time. She had a wonderful word for living books as opposed to what she called twaddle. Isn't twaddle a great word? Like, we don't read twaddle. We read living books. She says that, "For the mind is capable of dealing with only one kind of food. It lives and grows and is nourished upon ideas only. Mere information is to it as a meal of sawdust to the body." Which I would say, that's like truth by itself, set over on a corner, can become a bit of sawdust. I know that sounds heretical, but just understand the context of what I'm saying. What is an idea? We ask that we find ourselves plunged beneath our depth. "A living thing of the mind" seems to be the conclusion of the greatest thinkers, from Plato to Bacon, from Bacon to Coleridge. We all know how an idea, this is my point, it strikes, it seizes, it catches hold of, it impresses upon us, and if be big enough, it possesses us. If you've got an idea so rich that it's possessing you, it's pulling you in. We've been a part of these conversations. You don't want to leave the room because you're so raptured up in these ideas. They override everything else in the room around you. I would put that in the category of beautiful. It's not just it's flowery or it's artsy, but it's living and it's dynamic. Living and dynamic education that we are purveyors of, if presented properly in the classrooms, I think will offset, and basically, if I can use this analogy, it feels like you just put a stake in front of the students each day and they walk out into the digital world of Fruit Loops and it's just not that interesting. They're not hungry for that because your appetite has been formed on what is truly beautiful. I thought what Andrea did today on the ant and the grasshopper discussion was fantastic, because all of a sudden that simple story, we began to bring it alive and took on connections You even somehow tied it into Narcan, which I don't even know how that worked, but that was fascinating to me. But a great example of like, let's ground this in the real world in a way that connects the dots. We've minded the gap in a way that really makes it alive. I think the idea real quickly of just narration, which by the way is not just parroting it back, but if we believe the text is really alive, then we have the ability to ask the students to say back using the author's details and words in sequence. And so what happens is we get a mind-on-mind engagement with that living idea. And I think, again, one of the biggest challenges that we face in our movement is we don't know how to teach because we teach the way we were taught, or we read Gregory's Seven Laws and we still don't know what to do. And I think when we walk into classrooms as teachers, the biggest challenge is we get sometimes in the way of teaching. And I want to just show you this real quick clip of a great authority on how to teach. Mortimer Adler.
Lunch you will share is a person who is himself dedicated to continued general learning. Mm-hmm. That is, the best teacher, in my own experience, is the teacher who, in the course of teaching, is learning. The teacher who has learned it all and is merely becoming a means of transmission of dead knowledge that's dead for him because it's not being actively acquired at the time, I think is, if you use your word, not inspiring. Mm-hmm. The inspiration that happens in the classroom is when the students see the teacher learn something. Thinking, learning, ideas occurring. And that means the teacher has to be in, you know, I know it's kind of trite to say that Socrates was the greatest teacher, but he was.
Yeah.
And he was simply because he was teaching while conducting an inquiry. Mm-hmm. His teaching was the conduct of an inquiry in which the students were engaged in the inquiry with him. Mm-hmm. Now that seems to me is the kind of teaching that should go on in college.
Well, Socrates was also, was he not philosophically wedded to the notion that his principal job was to bring out that which was already latently inside his students, isn't that right?
In the Theaetetus, he describes himself as, when asked what he understands himself to be doing, he said, my performance is very much like that of the midwife. I don't give birth to ideas. The learner with whom I'm conversing gives birth to the ideas, and like the midwife, I'm there to make the labor pains of birth,
the maieutic function,
a lot easier. See? Yeah. In fact, the Socratic conception of teaching is one that is based upon the truth of the proposition that nothing that can be learned needs a teacher. The teacher is, anything that can be learned can be discovered by the learner without the aid of a teacher. The teacher is never more than an aid, making it easier, sometimes quicker, but never indispensable. That is, the active learner is the student.
So, again, this is worthy of a whole discussion. I hope you'll go have that discussion. But my simple point tonight is if we're going to come against the digital barbarians outside our doors, we're going to have to bring an education forward that is an absolute education that links clearly back to the person of Jesus Christ. It's got to be a more beautiful education that's presented using the living books, but we've got to bring those books to surface so that those ideas are engaged directly on the part of the student. And I would say part of a beauty is also the atmosphere of the school, the way we organize it. It's also experiential learning. Again, there's a lot to talk about here. I'll just quickly mention that one of the ways that I thought was a beautiful execution of beauty in a classical Christian school, this is our eighth grade MonCon, not to be confused with EdCon, but anyway, MonCon is where we basically, after studying the monastic order, which could be very heady and very abstract and very static, we have eighth graders design robes. They come to the school on a Friday night. We basically used to be all night. We learned that's not a great idea, but we go till about 1 a.m. and we recreate the monastic order. And they're having to go. They're there in the library at Ambrose. They're working on their illuminations. And they're not talking, and they're by candlelight, and they've just eaten a meal of stew, and they're experiencing at the visceral level the beauty of doing something that's transformative in community. These students, when they walk out and they've eaten this steak dinner, the Fruit Loops are going to look a little bit less appetizing because they've seen something that's truly done well. So my challenge again for us is how do we continue to put before them the best of classical Christian education in its most beautiful execution? Finally, I want to just mention an embodied education. And again, we've talked, all these things are in some ways like, yeah, we kind of know that, but I want you to really think about it. I think the ultimate secret sauce of what will make classical Christian education a powerful antidote to the desires of what's being spun up around us is when school is embodied in the lives of a real person. Jacques Ellul says, those who read the press of their group and listen to the radio of their group are constantly reinforced in their allegiance. So this is a real sobering reality that was hit home to me in college. I was a sociology major, and I went underground for 6 weeks in college as a Jehovah's Witness. I studied the cults, and I was really interested. And if I figured if I wanted to really understand them, I got to go be like one. And so I started going to a Kingdom Hall, and I was very serious with the elders. I said, I will become a Jehovah's Witness, but I really want to study it, and I really want to understand it. So I went faithfully to their services. I read their books. And finally, at the end of the 6 weeks, I said, I'm very curious. I have a lot of things I'm curious about. So would you find, you know, your best or your brightest to come meet with me? So I had an elder and his wife. They were in their 60s. They came to my college apartment, and I was very respectful. I said, I just need you to help me figure out a few things. I don't understand this 144,000 thing. I'm a little bit confused about that. There's some gaps in the history. I don't know what to do with this. And I basically kind of shredded it historically in front of him lovingly. And here's the point. He stood up, looked at me, looked at his wife, and said, I'm sorry. We need to go. He said, I've spent my whole life in this organization. My family's here. My children are here. And I don't think I can leave. And whatever you say may or may not be true. I don't even know. La, 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 la. I got to go. And he walked out. And I thought, that says everything right there. That if you have the power to control that identity of belonging, you now control everything. And I would dare say there's a lot of confusion, again, we don't have time for it all tonight, within the world of classical Christian education, in large measure because we can't figure this whole three-legged stool between the church and the home and the school. And so I've been in many around many classical Christian schools. They back up because they don't want to be the church. Well, I understand that. But the church isn't serving a lot of the needs of families right now. And you've got the home over here that's a lot more confused than the school. So I think the problem is we ended up in this with students in the middle that are looking for a community to belong in. And they're looking to their teachers to want to be like. And I love, Chris and I had lunch when I got here, and I love what you guys are doing at Gutenberg because so much of it is an embodied community. You can't help but be, you can't hide at Gutenberg. And I love that. That's not how it is in a lot of our schools because the teachers are not easily known. They're at a distance. I will tell you, honestly, I wouldn't be here tonight were it not for an individual named Donald Drew. Quick story, and we'll end here. My mother in the early 70s went through an agnostic period. She read Francis Schaeffer's books. She realized you can be a thinking Christian. Imagine that. She went off to Labrie Fellowship in Switzerland. When I was right out of high school, my parents had divorced. I was a typical American teenager. MTV, big read for me was Road and Track magazine. I went to church, got to Labrie Fellowship in Switzerland. And I was like, I don't know that I fit in here. I don't know. I'm just seeking, but I don't know. And a gentleman named Donald Drew came up to me and said, I want to work with you. I don't know if you, most of you, I guess, are familiar with Schaeffer and Labrie, but it's a Christian community where you basically live and work together. And so Donald came up and each morning would slip a note in my pocket and it would either be a scripture or a word of encouragement. He became my tutor basically while I was there. Later came to find out my big claim to fame. He also tutored Oz Guinness. So I was like, well, that's, you might have something to offer me, Donald. But he became honestly like a father figure. And here's my point. I'll never forget when I first week there, he said, I want you to read this book. It was Martin Lloyd-Jones's book, The Christian Soldier. And I'm looking at it going, okay, there's no pictures and small print, and I'm not really sure I want to read this. But he lovingly said, no, I want you to read this. We're going to meet and talk about it. He would invite me up to the top floor of his apartment in Bellevue and on Sunday afternoons, and we would have high tea. He was English, Cambridge graduate. And we would listen to classical music, which was hard for me as an American teenager because it went against everything I was comfortable with. I thought it was kind of boring. He would read the Chronicles of Narnia, and I'm like, I'm not a little kid. But after a few minutes of respecting, because I respected him, I listened, and I started getting interested. I started leaning in. Over the years, when I went back to college, I would take microcassettes, and I would record on the A side questions of my, you know, of theology and life, and I put them in an envelope. 2 weeks later, I get the B side back with Donald's wisdom on it. Still have those. I cherish them greatly. Donald became a role model, an embodiment of education. I would go visit him in London. He'd take me to the Tate Gallery. I never forget standing at the Tate Gallery in front of this Rembrandt, the Belshazzar's Feast. And again, I remember initially walking in and looking at this beautiful piece and thinking, some dude with a hat, I remember he's writing on the wall. And he's like, no, look at it. Describe it to me. Sit here and think about it. And again, I respected him enough that he was that enthralled in this, that it made me enthralled in it. The embodiment of that education awakened me to the wonder and the joy of classical Christian education. And so I just want to encourage us tonight, when we think about what is the antidote, it's we have all the tools in front of us. Are we more concerned with jamming through our lesson plans, or is there a way to actually slow things down, take these living books, awaken children to them, have these discussions, get out of the way of that mind-in-mind engagement, find ways of being in their lives and connecting? One of the most loved teachers at our school at Ambrose is Tom Velasco. Tom's a 12th grade teacher. And I will tell you, having been his upper school dean, he's the most frustrating teacher too, because he doesn't always turn his lesson plans on time. And he's quick to kind of talk and go off script a bit sometimes. But there is not a graduate from that school that does not venerate him. And so often they come back at Christmas, and where do they go? They go to see Tom Velasco. And they want to sit with him, and they want to talk to him, because they know that he knows them. He knows their birthday. He goes to some, he's aware of their athletic events. He's in their life. He's their Donald Drew. And so think about how, in whatever ways God opens up that opportunity to create an embodied education for you. So tonight, I want to encourage you. I've hit you with some very heavy storm clouds of the digital craziness out there. Be sober to it. Don't underestimate it. At the same time, God has given us, I really believe, the tools that are the last best hope for our civilization. We have an education that's tied to the absolutes of Jesus Christ. We have a beautiful education that brings alive everything that's true, good, and beautiful. And we have an opportunity to be in the lives embodying this education. So the world today is curious. They're hungry. Millennial Gen Z moms and dads so want somebody to walk next to them. And they're more open than ever before to classical Christian education as a powerful antidote to the modern world. Thank you.
That was Teaching Independent Thinking in a Digital Dependent World by Davies Owens. You've been listening to a recording provided by Gutenberg College. You can find more information about Gutenberg College on our website at www.gutenberg.edu. Any broadcast or retransmission of this recording without the express written permission of Gutenberg College and the conference speaker is prohibited. Thank you for listening.